Hello friends, welcome to or welcome back to A Runner's Life podcast. In this episode I speak with Tim Saw, who is the founder of Saw Running. I just want to say a big thank you to Saw for sponsoring this series of episodes in my build-up for the London and Berlin marathons. In this series I've spoken to a number of people associated with the brands, from Saw athletes to people that are affiliated with the brand, that are keen supporters of the brand. So thank you to Claire Elms, thanks to George Schweining, thanks to Carl Gloucester, thanks to Rob Wilson, thanks to Rebecca, thanks to everyone that's helped and supported this series. And with that being said, let's head to the conversation with Tim. Hi Tim, welcome to A Runner's Life podcast. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, Marcus. Hello to you as well.
Thanks for coming on the podcast. What does A Runner's Life mean to you?
Big question. I'm sure they all say that. So obviously Runner's Life means, you know, both running as a physical activity, but it's also my career now, which adds a level of complexity to it. What it means to me as a sport, if you like, is it means a time for me to get out into nature and a time for me to enjoy being outside and having a kind of dialogue with my body. And I guess when I first discovered sport very late in life, before that, I'd been doing creative careers, and so spending a lot of time in my head, but not very much time in my body. So running grounds me in my body. And I think, you know, it's really important that people have that. And then as my career, then it suddenly opened that up a lot more. And so I spent a lot of time running, thinking about product and testing product. And that then, strangely enough, takes me back into my head. So ironically, it's gone full circle.
I think it's really interesting you talk about how, where you are now, that there's running's a part of your personal life, but it's also a part of your work. How do you create the division between the two?
Yeah, so I suppose, I mean, there's enough. I mean, I think anyone who does sort of structured training, there's enough variety in the type of runs you do to keep that within the kind of running world, the pure running world, if you like. So if I'm doing a long tempo run, I'm not thinking about the running business unless I've got a particular product I'm testing and it's not working. Hopefully it is working and I'm not thinking about it. So I guess there's enough variety within the type of running I do not to have to think about it the whole time. But I guess I don't even put it into sort of compartments like that. It is what it is. It's what I do both as a physical activity and as what I do in my career. And it's not a problem to me the fact that those two intersect.
Trying to make it seem like there has to be a boundary, or try to create that, makes it a thing, which then makes it quite uncomfortable. So you kind of have to accept that they probably will merge between the two, and like, that's fine.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And as long as it doesn't become, you know, a chore. And if it becomes a chore, then I think that would be problematic. But I think it's just as likely to become a chore from, you know, being on a getting stuck into training and getting fatigued from training. That's much more likely to be problematic than it becoming your job as well.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I know in previous interviews you've talked a lot about how Saw started and the early days, which we won't cover, but I kind of want to go back a little bit. Can you talk about where you are today and how the culture, the vision of Saw has evolved since the early days?
Yes, I can. Yes. And that, you know, again, that's quite a big subject. So I'll try and keep it sort of prescient a bit. So when it first started, I thought the brand was a kind of a visually led offer, if that makes sense. It was like fashion. So it was about how things looked. And the more I've done it and the more mature the brands have become, I'm now absolutely sure that it's about how things perform and how things work. And then how they look is the sort of secondary part of that, is the emergent property that comes from that. So that's a big paradigm shift. And the reason that happened was because, you know, after I started doing it for a while and testing more products and testing more competitor products, I realized how unevolved a lot of running clothing was, and therefore it was very obvious the opportunity was to really focus on performance, because it seemed to be that's where the big space in the market, big gap in the market was. And I still believe that's true. And that's why Sawdust Well is because we have this focus on performance. So I would say we've moved from being a kind of visual brand to being a performance-focused brand. I don't think there's a huge amount of competition in that space. You know, other individual brands have performance elements to their offer, but I don't think any of them are purely focused on performance in the running space that we are. So I guess that's how it's evolved. And obviously it's a bigger team now. So part of the evolution is understanding how to work with a bigger team of people. And that's been very interesting for me personally and professionally. That's the headline ways, if you like, in which it's evolved.
I think that's really interesting because you spoke about just how it was visually led at the start, but then it moved into performance. When I look at it now, I kind of feel like it's a hybrid of both, really. I'm not saying it's just about the visuals, but it performs well, but it looks great as well. So I don't think you've lost touch from the original beginnings.
Oh yeah, I think it has to be beautiful. You know, I come from a kind of design background. Things have to look great, but I guess it's more the mindset that the beauty of the product, as I said, is an emergent property. If the product's right and it's performance focused and it does fit for purpose, then it's going to have an inherent beauty to it, and then all you need to do is enhance that, basically. So yeah, absolutely. I'm not saying we neglect the kind of visual side of it. No, that's a key component as well.
Even when I think about the classic race vest, and that for me feels like when you're wearing it, it almost feels like you're not wearing anything, but you are wearing something. It doesn't get in the way of the act, and it makes it, and it feels like it dries quickly. And this is not just me saying it because you're here, but you know, it does look good, but also performs very well. It doesn't, you're not running thinking, oh, my singlet is like clinging to me or makes me feel heavy or whatever. It almost feels like it's part of you.
Yeah. So that's really interesting because I had just on that product, the moment of clarity I had on that product, exactly as you say, when you're completely not aware of it, I was running. So we had a previous race vest. And it was made in, so the original race vest was made in different fabric. And anyway, we'd arrived at this fabric, but it was a much looser garment. It was much more like a traditional race vest. And I went to Mallorca one summer and I only had a small sample to wear. So it was really quite tight. And it was very hot and I was running in the middle of the day because that's the only time I could run. And halfway through the run, I thought, oh, I forgot to put a top on. And in fact, what had happened is the vest had wetted out. And because it sat really close to the skin and because of the cut of the garment, it didn't feel clingy. All it felt like was, it felt like you weren't wearing anything. You weren't aware of it at all. And yeah, that has to be the aspiration with any running garment. You want to be able to forget about it as quickly as possible, because if you don't, the garment's getting in the way and that's stopping you enjoying your run. So absolutely, that's my aspiration for any garment. It needs to become as kind of transparent in the way you're wearing it, if you like, ergonomically transparent, as fast as possible.
I also want to go back to something you said earlier as well about in the growth of SOAR, about more people coming in and expanding the team and just where you're moving towards collectively. Can you talk a little bit about that in terms of the culture and how you've had to work from obviously being solo then to bringing people in and making them feel part of the brand and the culture?
Yeah, I mean, that has been, as I said, it's been super interesting. And in fact, that's been a significantly bigger learning curve for me personally than the kind of design side. The design side was, I was a mature designer in as much as I had a long career. I knew what I was doing. I know what I'm doing. I have a great skill at understanding how garments interact with the body. Whereas growing the team, because I'd always worked either by myself or as a freelancer with people, I'd never actually had to work with a team of other people. And understanding that dynamic and understanding how to get the best from people it took me quite a long while to understand. And in fact, what you have to do is you have to remove yourself and your ego from it as much as possible and allow people to shine. Sounds obvious to say, but it's, you know, until you actually experience it, it's not obvious. So understanding that all the people in the team, their experience of running is different to my experience of running. And some of them have been, you know, hardcore runners from the get-go, and I'm only a very late convert to endurance sport. So their understanding is different to my understanding it. And that's all to the strength of the business, that you then have a more rounded, you know, the whole business then has a kind of more rounded take on the sport. So it's great. You bring in people who've got a different take on you. You bring in, obviously, people who are as talented as possible, and you let them do their thing, and you don't try to run a dictatorship. It's a, you know, it's a democracy. All the businesses that I've been involved with, the more democratic they are, the better the business has been culturally and financially. So, you know, so I try to have as flat a management structure as possible. I try to let people do their own thing as much as possible. And that gives you a successful business, or it gives, you know, given us a successful business anyway.
I think even wider than business, it's almost like a psychological thing you're talking about there. It's just about not losing yourself, but also being aware of other people, being consciously aware and unconsciously aware of just like your interpretations, your thoughts, how you put that on people, and just kind of trying to get out of your own way to allow things to happen.
Exactly right, yeah.
The only reason I sort of thought that, because I was listening to a podcast, I think, with Deepak Chopra, and he was talking about just the thoughts and just being consciously aware of the thought and stepping away in yourself from the thought. So that's what kind of made me think of what you said, that even though it was completely unrelated, but it's funny how all these things do tie in together.
Absolutely. And without wanting to kind of talk about something which has become becoming a little bit cliche, I think the one thing about running and mental space is that it does, there's something about being on a run when it's going right that allows you to step outside your everyday normal thinking mindset. And I think, you know, that kind of slightly meditative quality of it is interesting and psychologically beneficial, particularly to men. I think something that's particularly beneficial to men about it. And that's not to say, and that's not in any way to disparage women runners, but I think particularly men can have quite, you know, emotionally quite closed lives, and there's something about running that can open that up a little bit.
I can definitely relate to that. But I was also thinking, in addition to what you said about when the run feels like it's right, but then not often, I don't want to make it get my violins out, but sometimes it feels like there's runs which don't go right, the runs that don't enjoy.
Yeah. It's just like, too many of those.
Yeah. I feel like there's a lot more learning in those as well.
Yeah, it's a different kind of learning, that one, isn't it? That's a kind of mental endurance, those ones. Yeah, you can't force it. It just comes or it doesn't come. Yeah, that's
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, even when it goes right, I think it works really well. And I remember recently, this is unrelated, but I went for dinner after the London Marathon with some friends. And it's one of those moments where you know, you're consciously feeling happy, but you're not forcing it. And you're just aware, you step outside yourself that you're happy. It's like you have those runs and you have those moments in life where you're just like, wow, everything's aligning. You're just trying to be in the moment, but enjoy it at the same time.
Yes. Yeah. As I said, I suspect all you can do is you can make yourself as open to those moments to come as possible, but you can't force them to come.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about product development. So when you're looking at like sourcing the products, and how do you sort of make those decisions between getting the material, sourcing the products, but then also thinking about the commercial side? Because I don't think people always appreciate that, especially when you're releasing new products.
So to start with the commercial first is normally, or what has happened, and this it sounds logical with hindsight, but maybe isn't logical at first, is the more real a garment is, the more it ticks a box in your arsenal of running clothing you need, the more commercial it is. And it doesn't matter how niche that need is. So if I'm running and I'm thinking, what I'd quite like now is a garment to do X, Y, or Z, and that's really quite a niche need, you know, it's going to happen once every 10 runs or whatever, then that garment's likely to be quite commercial because there's going to be a lot of other people thinking the same thing. So I guess, you know, a good illustration of that is that like a long sleeve hot weather t-shirt. So that's counterintuitive. The hotter the weather, then just wear a singlet. But actually, I was becoming, because I'm getting older, I was becoming more and more concerned about UV exposure didn't want to be slathering myself with suntan cream the whole time, because that's just putting another load of chemicals on you. So I thought, yeah, of course, I want a long sleeve t-shirt that's really light and airy that I can run in warm weather. And in fact, our hot weather t-shirts are really good sellers, because there's plenty of other people who think the same thing. So the ideas come by and large from running and from the experience of running. Then executing it, well, that's something quite different than how you get from kind of the thought from A to B, the kind of finished product. Sometimes it's super easy, and sometimes you know. So with the hot weather t-shirts, for instance, we took the Race Fest fabric, which has a, you know, we have a huge amount of R&D, so real world R&D on that fabric. We know it works, we know it's really cool. And then on the top part, we just put a fabric which is still very light, which gives you almost complete sun protection. So that was a pretty quick product to evolve. There's other products, the graphene vest, for instance, I think, which you ran Boston in, which is a no-brainer concept, but actually getting it to the point where it was workable in within these kind of fairly narrow set of temperature conditions was 2.5-3 years, something like that. And that was a very problematic one, because just technically the challenge of putting a graphene print on a very light fabric and how that felt, what the user experience of that was above and beyond the temperature controlling properties of the graphene heat circuit. So sometimes it's quick, sometimes it's slow. And you know, I now have a wide library of different suppliers who I know can supply very technical fabrics. I now have a very good idea of the type of things we're going to need to do to get a garment to work. And that's just experience. But sometimes it's quick and sometimes it's slow. But the truth about the commercial side is that if it comes from a genuine real world need as a runner, it's likely to be commercial. And the more performance focused it is, and this again sounds an obvious thing to say, so the more it's within the racing world, the more commercial it becomes. And I think the reason for that is because, you know, I certainly do myself, and I think every runner does, you put a huge amount of emotional and mental and physical effort into getting to the start line, if you're at all PB and competitively aware. You know, that, and you know, Marcus, this more than any of us, I would imagine, you know, the desire to perform on the day after all this stuff that you've done, after all this running you've done, this time you could have been doing other things, all those hard runs where you didn't get in the right mental space and it was a real graft and a grind and all of that stuff. The more you can help people in that, when they're on that start line, the more commercial something's going to be, because we all need help when we're there, basically. Whatever fitness level we are, we all want a little bit of extra help at that stage, which, you know, that's why there's been the rise of the super shoes as well. So very performance-focused products tend to do very well commercially, and you think of those when you're on your run, and I have a big skill set in understanding how to put those ideas into actuality.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. If we talk about it, especially the performance side, and there is an audience there is a framework there, but then I guess at the same time, it's then the stuff outside that people don't probably appreciate, that you still need to work out, okay, well, this is the much material I need to purchase, and this is how much I think I'm going to sell or might not sell. So you need to get that balance right, because you can't think like, it's almost like Field of Dreams, like I'll build it and they come, and then no one comes.
Has happened occasionally. Yeah, I mean, that side, sort of production planning and forecasting, you know, and especially because we've been through COVID. So every online sportswear brand had a massive boom in COVID. Anything online obviously had a massive boom in COVID. So we had, and as did we. And what that meant is people then massively got their production forecasting wrong post-COVID, because they thought that was, you know, going to be the new normal, and it wasn't. People went back to real life, you know, go figure. So yeah, production planning is challenging, and you can get it wrong, and then you're stuck with a lot of stock. And to swerve the question a little bit, what we definitely try not to do, and what is, I think, inherently ungreen, and the most inherently ungreen thing you can do as a brand, is massively overstocked and then massively discount to have to clear that stock. That's not good for the environment. It really isn't. So we do very, very limited discounting. We really try not to have excess stock to have to clear, which occasionally does happen, but we try not to. So yeah, you have to try to get that right. And that's probably the hardest bit of it, actually, to be frank. It's much harder than, you know, going through 50 iterations of graphene fabric. That there's a known process for production planning. Yeah, much harder.
Yeah, that makes sense. And even we talk about that, and you talk about that in relation to the graphene vest, which came out, and I think there was about 40 or so.
Yeah.
Garments altogether.
Yeah.
And I was fortunate enough to test this in Boston. I was willing for good weather, but it didn't happen. Got rained on again. But you know, actually, one of the unforeseen really positives of that vest was it dried really quickly. In the first 10K, we had drizzle, but we had headwind. And I was really like surprised how quickly it dried. But I guess it's the graphene print, which kind of creates that space between your body and the material. So it really works really well in that aspect.
Did you find it getting very cold when it got wet? That's the only thing. That's the only slightly thing you have got to watch a bit. In cold conditions, the graphene can actually be feel very, very cold because it's just transferring any kind of wind chill around the rest of the torso.
I feel like the first half of the marathon, it was light rain, it was headwind, so I felt like it dried off. But towards the end of the race, we had like heavy downpours and I was just soaked anyway. Yeah. So
yeah, at that point, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Yeah, fair enough.
It's like you're standing outside literally in a vest and what could effectively be your boxer shorts. Yeah, you're going to be cold anyway, really.
Yeah, true enough.
But, you know, talking about the graphene vest from the Proto Lab, I also spoke to Carl Gloucester, who's on the podcast, and he wore the marathon speed suit.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about these products which fall under the Proto Lab products?
Yeah, so the Proto Lab concept is, you know, what happens if you really stretch the elastic, and that can be into a really pure performance space, quite a niche pure performance space, or it can be into a much more fashion space, if you like. So for instance, there's jeans, denim jeans, sitting in the Proto Lab alongside a graphene vest and a marathon speed suit. So the Proto Lab is small production runs and things that I think are quite niche, but we want to do, and they might not become niche down the line, if you like. So they might be things that move into the main collection. And the graphene vest, before I come to the speed suit, is fairly niche because it has these quite narrow temperature conditions it works in. So between 10 and 11 degrees and 18 degrees, that's when sort of conductive cooling is the dominant cooling system for the body. And it works then when you move above that, then evaporative cooling, sweating becomes the more dominant system and the graphene stops working. So that seems pretty niche to me, and it's a 160 quid vest, so it's quite expensive. So we started with that in Proto Lab. The speed suit, again, is, you see, this is interesting. The speed suit I thought was very niche, and now I've worn it a few times, I actually think, why wouldn't you be wearing it? Frankly, so it started. I had always planned to do, well, always planned for the last 2 years, planned to do a short distance speed suit, you know, a kind of 5-10K speed suit. So moving from the track to middle distance, you know, 5-10K, so shorter distance events. And then we had an intern join the business, a guy called Alex Bagnall, who, and part of his portfolio was a one piece marathon suit, which was but that was more like a split shorts with a vest attached. And seeing that and with his, you know, his extensive capabilities and mindset, that thought, okay, well, actually, maybe the marathon's the place we want to do that. So we had a lot of prototypes, or Alex had a lot of prototypes to make to get it right. So step back from that first. So the reason, why would you want a marathon speed suit? Because if you are running more than about 10 miles an hour, and quite a few runners running more than 10 miles an hour, aerodynamics starts to become an issue. Even if you're running a bit slower than 10 miles an hour, aerodynamics is still an issue, and aerodynamic drag increases exponentially. So, you know, the bit more faster you go above that, the significantly more important it becomes. So from that point of view, aero has to be a thing in running, and that's why they had that kind of Kipchoge formation when he did his sub two, where he's in his kind of flying V formation. So aerodynamics is clearly a thing in running, and the marathon speed suit is the most aerodynamic way you can dress for a marathon. So that's the kind of the basic premise for it. The difficulty of it is how you get it light enough and cool enough and still allow you to be able to put six gels in it and have it comfortable enough and all of that stuff. So that's the bit which took a lot of prototyping to really get the different bits of it working. But it does work now. And as I said, I thought this was going to be quite a niche thing. And as part of the product testing, I wore it during cross country under the race, under my race vest. Couldn't really get a sense of it. Then I ran and a half in it, and yeah, it's pretty revealing. It's pretty skin tight all over. And at the start line, I was kind of thinking, well, okay, but I feel like a little bit exposed here. Yeah. But as soon as you get going, and as soon as you're running, and as soon as you finished, it's like, yeah, this is fantastic, because I feel so, you know, locked into the garment that I'm wearing to race. It's brilliant. And then I started doing a few long tempo runs just to do further long threshold runs to do further testing in it. And as I said, at the end of those, I was thinking, you know, why wouldn't you wear this? And then look, we had a couple out being tested, Carl, one of them at London Marathon. And actually, when you look at it in the pictures, it just looks like it looks fine. It doesn't look any different really to what everyone else is wearing. So I suspect it's a suit which might have significantly more traction than we think. So it might move from Protolab into the Times race range. But anyway, it's going to be Protolab, and we're going to do a short production run of them, hopefully in time for autumn marathons.
It's really interesting to hear about the testing that goes into it, that you do, that your colleagues do, that the athletes do, just to make it work. I mean, it made me laugh thinking about those stories at cross country, because I'm sure people have had like garment malfunctions just through stuff they haven't let go.
I definitely got some looks in the changing room. So one of the ones which was actually took a bit of time to crack is kind of toilet functionality. Because if you're running a track race, or even if you're running a 5K or 10K race, you probably don't really need to have a pee break. Well, you definitely don't have a track break, and you probably get away with it on a 5-10K. But at marathon, you know you've got to get there early. You know there's going to be a lot of people there. You know there's going to be start line nerves. So you're going to need to take a toilet break. And once you're in that suit, you've got your number pinned on, it's not coming off again. So getting that functionality to work, which is part of real world user experience, and that's just as important as having a kind of functional fast suit, is, you know, can you get to the race line as a good runner and have it work for you and, you know, be able to do what you need to do. So that's all a key part of the testing process. You can't just have a garment that's, you know, super fast if it then doesn't work in a kind of real world runner experience, you know, the real experience for a real world runner, to mangle it a bit. So you have to test it. You have to test it, and you have to test it, and you have to test some more. And that's everything that comes out of the doors at Saw has had significant testing.
Yeah. When you do look at the photos of Carl running London Marathon, it does look like completely normal. It just looks like someone wearing a singlet and some half tights, one.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, okay, fine, no problem. Just why wouldn't you wear that? And I, you know, I genuinely think, and this isn't a salesy, so, well, it's a slightly salesy talk, but it genuinely felt really good to wear. It was, even for a half marathon, it felt really good to wear.
I mean, one more thing as well. I think the good thing about it doesn't stick out. It kind of reminds me, do you remember when Kathy Freeman wore that all-in-one bodysuit back in the Olympics way back? And that stuck out.
Yeah.
It doesn't stick out that much.
Yeah, it doesn't stand out that much, exactly.
One thing I do want to go back to is you mentioned jeans, which I imagine is from just the normal day wear.
Yes.
How does that fit into the Protolab and the running side?
So as I said, the Protolab is all about what happens if you stretch the elastic from you know, what is the center of Saw. So stretching elastic one way takes you into a very highly niche performance product, and the world of kind of marginal gains, if you like. And then stretching the product the other way takes you into into style and lifestyle and fashion. And that's also part of my background. So that's there in my DNA. And so the jeans incorporate, they've got a kind of darted ergonomic construction style, which comes from the learnings from Saw and the way you produce ergonomic garments. So it's a way of taking the kind of Saw core learnings and applying them to clothing that's outside the core, the very core of the business. So the jeans sit there because they apply this construction style and this pattern cutting technique. And that's what relates back to the business. And the graphene vest is there because it comes back to the kind of core part of the race business. We have a much more lifestyle raincoat coming into Proto Lab, and that takes all our kind of wet weather gear learning and applies it into a raincoat that you can wear every day. So it's a way of saying how does Saw talk to the world that's around Saw, if you like, broadly speaking, within apparel, obviously, within clothing or within accessories or whatever. So how can this brand that we built and this understanding we have about the way garments work with the body and the way they work with the environment, how can we take that understanding and apply it outside of the core brand?
I think that's a really interesting conversation to have, especially the lifestyle element between the running and the things outside. Like, for example, if you look at some of the stuff that Tracksmith do.
Absolutely, yeah. I guess the difference between the way, and you know, this has taken some thinking and we've only really crystallized how it's going to work recently. I think the difference between the way perhaps Tracksmith do it and the way Protolab is that Protolab garments will be special within their own right. And that's not to say Tracksmith garments aren't special within their own right. We're not going to be producing a standard hooded sweatshirt, if you like, unless it has some, you know, unless there's a significant bit of soreness that we can put within that sweatshirt. So every garment that comes from Protolab will be interesting and standalone in its own right. It doesn't have to, it's not about, at the moment, we're not doing a kind of a lifestyle range that would include t-shirts and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's Protolab products are special, basically. I guess that's the mindset about them. And they have to have interest in their own right and they have to be a thing in their own right. So that's how that would differentiate from just a more kind of lifestyle offer.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's kind of made for certain elements of time, yeah, as opposed to just like the whole look.
Yeah, correct, yeah.
I don't know why I thought something completely random, like an all-in-one suit, those ways. It wouldn't work though. And I might put that to you as an option because I don't think the R&D would pay for that anyways, or ICO would pay for it, so yeah. But I think it's really interesting. We've got the products from the Protolab, but then you've got the things for the everyday running. So like, for example, something that's coming out recently is the new hydration half tights, which I think is a really interesting concept.
Okay, so that's a really interesting example of thinking of a product which, to any normal person, normal inverted commas, non-runner, you go, well, that seems incredibly niche, a pair of shorts that you can put, you know, water bottles on. But actually, real world runner experience, you know, if you're running in hot weather, and having had some experience of cycling before I moved to running, where you would always take hydration, you know, why is it that runners on long runs, why aren't they taking hydration with them in hot weather? Because it's going to, you know, impact on your recovery. If you're poorly hydrated, if you've become dehydrated in your long run, that's going to impact on your recovery. It's going to make you tired, or it's going to make your run less pleasant, all of that stuff. So, and this came out of, and this was an ancillary benefit almost, these shorts, because they came out of testing trail products. And to test trail products, I was wearing a pack a lot, because a lot of them is about how kit interacts with when you're wearing a pack. And I was wearing a pack, and obviously then I had water, and suddenly I thought, oh Jesus, this is great. I can, you know, I don't feel like I'm like a dried up husk when I finish my long runs in summer, which before I was, frankly. And so therefore it's like, okay, how do we do a version of this where you're not taking quite as much water because you're only doing an hour and a half or 2 hour run, but enough to stay hydrated. And then it's like, well, of course, put them on the garment. Where do we put them on the garment? Then the sort of R&D development of that became simple. It's where do you put them on the garment? How do you get it there? How do you stop it bouncing? How do you make it strong enough? And then those are all fairly, you know, straightforward steps that you take. And they've done great. You know, they've launched and they're selling well. And, you know, again, it's a product once it's there, once you see it, you can't unsee it. Yeah, of course, you want to take water with you when you're doing long runs in warm weather. Why wouldn't you?
Do you know what's really interesting about that product and the need that runners have is that for me, when I run, especially marathons, I tend to have a belt and I carry flexible flasks. So when I saw it, I thought, oh, that kind of speaks to me because I would carry my water with me. I know sometimes you can have the options of having gels like you talked about in a speed suit, but for me, the hydration element works. So I carry 250 mils and these ones, I think it's like 350 each side.
That's right.
Is it also used for racing or is it just for just training? Do you think it'll be an option in the future?
You definitely could take it racing for sure. Absolutely. I mean, my lived experience of them, if you like, was for training, for long trainings. But for sure, if you wanted to take them on, and you know, it's no different from taking a hydration pack if you're doing a trail race. So, you know, if you want to do a race where there's not water available, then yeah, sure, take them. Or if you don't want to have the faff of trying to grab, you know, snatch the cup of water which you miss or it spills or whatever, then you've got to wait another 4 miles before the next water station. For sure. Yeah, absolutely.
I think that just the design that goes into it in terms of just making sure it sticks, it's got that bounce. And this is first world problems, but like for runners, other people probably won't care.
Yeah, don't care.
When I'm racing, lifting your singlet to get your belt, to get the drinks out or to put it back in again, you know, that is a bit of a faff, which you do waste time. So to be able to kind of have it purposely made so you can just kind of reach down, pick it up, put it back down again with less faff, I think that's actually quite a cool thing to see.
Yeah, great. Well, good. I hope you're going to be using them. And also the thing about soft bottles is when they're full, it's fine. And when they're kind of half full, then they're kind of floppy because originally we tested it with soft bottles and then it's like, oh, God, it's trying to, you know,
the
it's
weight
a real
keeps,
faff to,
keeps boofing,
the
yeah.
weight keeps moving around, yeah. all of that stuff. So, yeah.
But it's cool to see it happening, though, to be honest. But it's one of those things that you sort of think in your head, but you don't actually say. And then you see it in real life, like, that just makes sense. That's exactly what I've been looking for, but not thought to ask about. I just want to go back to the business, really. And I know we covered some of it in the beginning, but I wanted to ask, what do you think has been, I'm sure there's been many, and this could probably be a conversation over dinner or a few dinners, but what has been, when you think about it, what's been some of your greatest challenges and some of your greatest successes within sore running?
So, greatest challenges, that's interesting. So, scaling effectively, learning how to get a team working really well, that's probably been the most outside my comfort zone, so that's been quite a big challenge, if you like. And then there's all sorts of kind of business stuff about, you know, you've got to raise money if you're not profitable and you're not going to be profitable in the early days. So there's kind of the financing side of that. And that's been, and we definitely had some challenges there. We had some significant challenges about a year and a half ago, which I won't go into. But anyway, we had a bit of a car crash when we were out for reasons out of our control. And that made doing some financing much trickier than it ought to have been. And I guess you learn lessons there, you know, you learn lessons through your mistakes. So that's definitely been challenging. From a product point of view, the only real challenges were the early days. In the very, very early days, we had some production from a Chinese factory that was significant. The fit was really wrong. And the whole point about SOAR is things should fit well and they should work well. So if they don't fit properly, then, you know, that's your table stakes out the window. If I knew then what I knew now, I'd just send it back to them and said, we're not going to accept it. But I didn't then, so we did. So that was a bit of a challenge. I would say the greatest success is probably in pure racing products. You know, those are head and shoulders by far the most significant revenue items for the business. And they're also, you know, when we were doing the marathon shorts and going, well, this is going to be £130 pair of skimpy shorts, there were a lot of questions around about, are you sure? You know, are you sure that seems crazy? And after the race fest, they're our second best-selling item. And the race vest is our best-selling item, and that's a £75 vest. So proving that if you give people, you know, value for money, or rather, value isn't just price-driven. value is, if you have a lot of value, then products will justify a higher price.
I think there's so much in that, but I thought it was really interesting you talk about just some of the successes and when things go well, but then also, you know, when things are challenging. And I'm not going to press you into that, but it's made me think as well. It's just, you know, you've started this brand, you've created this vision, you've got your own family situation, but then you're also responsible for other people's families and their situations as well. So that sounds, and I heard you talk about, I thought, wow, that's a lot of pressure that people probably don't always think about, especially when you're not running your own business. So that must be, I'm not going to push you to go into that, but I just want to highlight the thing, like, it's obviously quite, just made me think of what you said there.
But the way you alleviate that pressure is you have a really good team and you have a very flat management structure, so that, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but that pressure is shared, and it's shared between all of us, and that then makes it more manageable.
Yeah, that makes sense. Where do you think the running culture, the running industry is heading towards?
I don't think I know running, and I saw it with cycling. I saw the cycling boom. I started cycling in 98, and I really saw how that boom happened. And I've moved to running, obviously, for many years now. And it does feel that running is in a very similar space to cycling was then, in as much as it's becoming, there's far more people running, there's far more women running, it seems to me, which is fantastic. Or I'm certainly aware, perhaps, let's rephrase that, perhaps I'm just more aware that women are happier to run by themselves now, which, and that's, you know, that's a fantastic thing. And it just feels like it's going through a period of being quite hot, but not at the top of the sport. And that's ironic, because when cycling was hot, it was also at the top of the sport, it was hot. So there seems to be this kind of slight disconnect between the world of, you know, everyday runners and you know, good amateur runners, and what's happening at the kind of professional, inverted commas, level of the sport. So that's interesting. But running is, you know, is heading into boom time, I think, and which is great. And there's also, there's been this shift that has been, you know, has been started not just by Saw by any means, but by a number of other brands. So there's been this shift towards more boutique offers for runners, and I think that's a really positive thing. And then there's been the whole evolution of the kind of super shoe, and which has been a kind of cultural shift, I think, in as much as people have become more equipment focused. Perhaps your average runner is now more equipment focused than perhaps they would have been 10, 15 years ago. And for a business like us, that's a great thing. So it feels like it's, you know, it's entering a period, or has been in that for a while, of growth, and it's booming, but with this interesting mismatch between that and what's happening at the very top of the sport, where it seems it's stuck, and it seems it needs to reinvent itself. It doesn't seem to, it has to reinvent itself, and I'm just not sure how that reinvention is going to happen.
To add in what you've just said there, it made me think, especially at the grassroots level of the sport, I feel that, especially with run crews, run clubs, a lot of social media presence, I feel that people can see a lot of people that relate to them and speak to them on that level. Whereas I sort of feel like when you look at the top end of the sport, like, you don't really get a gauge of the personalities of the people. Yeah. And I know it's a solo sport, or a peer solo sport. They've obviously got teams, but it's different in the sense of, say, like a team sport, where you might get to see the personalities of the players because it's spread across the team. Whereas I think there's so much pressure on one person that doesn't always come across. So you see a very controlled person pre and after the race, but you don't really hear much during. So it's kind of like there's a disconnect.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting, isn't it, about the solo nature of the sport versus a team sport. Yeah, I think it's, you know, if there were sort of easy answers to it, I'm sure someone would have cracked it by now. But there's something not quite right. And I think everyone in running, you know, any kind of level knows that something not quite right at the top level of the sport. And I guess it's just people are working on different ways to address that and to make it more exciting and to make it more engaging. And maybe it just needs to come from the bottom up, and there's no problem with that.
Yeah, I feel that that's right. I mean, I know I've spoken to Rob on the podcast, and he's been pretty instrumental with his club, the Night of 10,000s, which I think is really good for engaging. But I'd say it's good for people who are really engaged in the sport. I'm not saying it's not welcome to people outside the sport, but you're mostly going to get runners or club runners or people who are passionate about it turning up to these events as opposed to just a casual everyday person.
Yeah, although I can see, you know, if you went to the 10,000 meter PBs, if you were a casual observer, there's a lot more for you there than there are at 99% of of events like that, or like at 99.99% of events like that. So absolutely, that's, I think, the kind of ground up activations it needs, you know, that running needs. And it's great that, you know, Rob's been involved with it since day one, and Ben Pochi, you know, it's great they're doing that. It's a really powerful thing.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's better to have it than not have it. I just want to go back to something. We had a conversation years ago. I was getting negative comments from some detractors, and you gave me this great quote, and it basically said, I learned long ago never to wrestle with a pig. You both get dirty, and besides, the pig quite likes it. And I've always, that's by George Bernard Shaw, and I've always had that in my head when dealing with people.
I think it's Woodrow Wilson, in fact. It's US president. It's either Wilson or Roosevelt. It's one of those. But yeah, it's a brilliant quote, and it's a great... It's a great maxim for life as well, because it's so true.
It's so interesting you say that, because when I Googled it, literally about three or four people came up, and I was like, who said that damn thing?
They all want to take credit for it.
I'm gonna go on Wikipedia and say that I did it to it, just to claim it as my own. Trying to change Google history. But regardless of like who said the quote or not, but I think, like I said, it's helped me so much in terms of just getting that clarity. I'm just like, dealing with things, especially that you face online or even in person. You know, you talked about the business in terms of just like what goes into putting it together, but there's also like copycats, which we've seen in different brands that are trying to kind of copy the saw, more so the logo, and I think some kind of the fit, well, not the fit, but just the look. I mean, can you talk about that?
Yep, and just like 100%.
How you kind of manage that moving forward?
Yeah, well, I suppose if you paraphrase the don't wrestle with the pig quote as, you know, haters are going to hate, then you could paraphrase that as copiers are going to copy. Copying is inherently flattering from one perspective, because it means that you're doing stuff that people are noticing and you're doing it right, and so they want a piece of that action. Okay, so here is a good quote, which I think is or it's not exactly a quote, but a kind of a maxim, if you like, is... And it's also true both within running itself, but also within running any sort of business, and particularly a creative business, is, you know, don't look from side to side at what people are doing beside you. Look straight ahead, because that's where you're going. So if people are starting to, if you're copying people, you're looking side to side. You're not looking where you're going as your brand. So copying is a sign of weakness, basically. So if people start copying you, it means they haven't got any ideas of their own. There are a few clauses, you know, caveats to that rather, but that's essentially the truth. And it's also, you know, the same is true with running. If you've got someone on your shoulder, don't worry about what they're doing, worry about what you're doing. So that's something that's true. So generally my take on copying is, if people are doing it, they're looking at you and they're not looking at their own business. So or not looking where their point of uniqueness is, point of difference is. So that's good in the long run. And it's flattering because you're doing something right. So that's great. My one caveat to that would be that sometimes bad copies can generate good ideas. So there's something that often, and it happens a lot in music, and you'll hear an artist who's trying to copy another artist and they don't do it very well, and they come up with a sound that's really interesting because it's this kind of this weird approximation. So I suppose if there's some world out there where there's these weird approximations of saw, then maybe that is going to generate something interesting. But the closer the copy, the less original of the thinking, the weaker that business is going to be.
I think that's a really interesting point, because you can... If you go into it, we're just like, I'm going to try to copy this to make as much money or whatever, a reason outside yourself. I don't think the why is strong enough. When you went back to your why of like, it had to look a certain way, but then it had to perform a certain way. Like, even if you try to copy something, you haven't got all that behind it. So it's fairly weak.
Exactly. And that's why copying is generally, you know, is generally not a good thing to do, because you don't have everything else in the world around it.
Yeah, absolutely. If you were podcasting and you were interviewing yourself, what would you ask yourself?
Okay, that is an interesting question. What would I ask myself? What sort of runner are you?
I'm going to put that back to you, Tim. What sort of runner are you?
Unfortunately, fairly average. Yeah, just by a lot of hard work. Fairly hardworking one, but unfortunately not with a massive amount of natural talent.
I feel a lot of people can relate to that, to be honest.
I've got a lot more natural talent in product developing than I have in running.
It's true, because you think of like all the mindset and you think, yep, yeah, it's going to put it into this body to run. No, I think that's a great way to end a conversation, and I've really enjoyed talking with you, Tim. Thank you for being a guest on a Runner's Life podcast.
Thank you for the interview.
Thank you for listening to this episode of A Runner's Life podcast. If you've enjoyed this conversation, please do subscribe to be notified of new episodes. If something resonates with you, please let me know and share online. Also, you could do me a massive favor by leaving your review on the podcast platform which you selected, as it helps the podcast grow. Your support helps make this podcast possible. If you've got any questions, please do get in touch with me on my Instagram page at Marcus_runs. Your time is valuable. Thank you again for sharing your time with me.